This is the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting. Today's date is April 14th, 2011. Time is approximately 9:02 in the morning. We have with us today Senator Passavan, Senator Giesel, Senator Meyer, Senator Kukesh, I believe, is on his way. I expect today will be the last meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee during this regular legislative session. Before we begin, I want to thank each member of the committee for your hard work, engagement, and insightful questions you've contributed to the process. We've considered more than 31 pieces of legislation and moved 29 out of the committee. 10 of those have passed both of the bodies. We also have held several informative sessions on topics ranging from housing for homeless veterans to the possible effects of Alaska of nuclear fallout from the Japanese nuclear crisis. Please know that I appreciate the time and energy each of you has invested in the committee. I believe we have been smart, thorough, and efficient in our consideration of the bills referred to us. I would also like to take a moment to thank our committee secretary, Catherine Ellis, who has served us ably, and the LIO teleconference staff who have connected us with Alaskans across the state. I would also like to look forward to continued work during the interim on several items. We began this session including looking for government efficiencies. We have a website up and running which seeks suggestions from Alaskans on how to improve state government effectiveness and efficiencies. We will do more to reach out to Alaskans to get their ideas on this important topic during the months to come. I also hope to hold some hearings on items such as the bill before us today, which we have limited time to consider before us during the 90 days. I'd also like to thank my committee staffer, Michelle Seideman, who has been very helpful and very dedicated in her service to the state. Senator Kukesh is with us.
Thank you.
Today we have a single bill before us. It's a very important bill. It's Senate Bill 21, which would let Alaska public employees choose between a defined contribution and a defined benefit pension system. This bill was introduced recently by Senator Egan and has a companion in the House. Senator Egan and Jesse Keel, welcome to the committee. Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and provide us an overview of Senate Bill 21 and walk us through the packet before us.
I object. No way.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 121 this morning. I am Senator Dennis Egan, Senator from District B, Juneau, and with me, my staffer, Jesse Keel. He's my staff for Senate Finance, and speaking of Senate Finance, I apologize because we are also meeting this morning on legislation that hopefully will free things up the end of session, and so I will have to depart, but Jesse will give you the rundown of the bill and the analysis. I think the key points in Senate Bill 121 as I see them, and right off the bat, I'm a Tier 1 retiree, so I'm covered, but I'm worried about others. It's employee choice in this legislation between defined benefits and defined contribution. A military retiree signing on for a few more years of service with a city government will be able to choose defined contributions. But a state trooper who will put his life on the line for decades for Alaskans will be able to choose defined benefits. The new tier is less expensive and more predictable thanks to the medical change. You have to be Medicare eligible unless you have a full career of service. There's no big surprise in this legislation. It keeps all of Senate Bill 141 safeguards in place. Be a second actuary, Alaska experience studies, minimum salary for elected officials, armed board review with disinterested members. The list goes on. It's cheaper for the state of Alaska, municipalities, and school districts. In time, that'll free up several million dollars per year. In the long term, Alaska needs this. When the lower 48 gets out of its recession, we're going to have to compete again for teachers and engineers. $800 million a year in defined benefit checks was a real shock absorber for the Alaskan economy in just the last few years. roughly the same economic impact as the permanent fund dividend, by the way. The actuary's analysis in your packet does show lower costs for better benefits. I believe it's good for our employees, it's good fiscal management, and I believe it's the right thing to do for Alaskans. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair, for taking the time and the committee for hearing my bill, Senate Bill 121, on such short notice and so late in the session. And hopefully in the interim, the committee will be able to have hearings and do some negotiating and come up with a reasonable solution. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Egan. Do I have a motion to move the bill? Okay. I appreciate you coming out. Questions for the senator? Okay.
And again, Mr. Chair, Jesse Keel of my staff is here to go through the bill for you.
Jesse, could you let's walk through the bill. It's a fairly complex bill, and let's take a few minutes going through that section by section, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Dennis Egan. The bill you have before you adds a new tier to the state's defined benefit retirement systems. There are two retirement systems. The public employees retirement system covers employees of the state of Alaska, of municipalities, and a few school district employees who don't have teaching certificates. The teachers' retirement system, or TERS, covers certificated teachers of the state of Alaska. There are a few additional employers who participate in PERS and TERS, nonprofits, housing authorities. Certainly not all by any stretch, but predominantly we're talking about the employees of the state of Alaska, our cities and school districts. Mr. Chairman, as you know, Article 7, Section 12 of the Alaska Constitution protects an accrued benefit in a retirement system of the state. So when we make changes to our retirement system, they have to be forward-looking. They have to apply to new hires, folks who are not yet in one of the systems. And so that's the approach taken by this bill. In essence, what we do is give new hires, new entrants to the retirement systems, a choice between the current defined contribution tiers, which are Tier 4 in the PERS system and Tier 3 in the TERS system, and a new defined benefit tier. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'll start with Section 1.
Yeah, if we could go right down and do a section, that'd be very helpful.
Happy to. Actually, Sections 1 and 2 taken together are meant to clarify that the teacher's retirement system defined benefit statutes, and that's the spanning reference there, 1425.009 through 220. The defined benefit statutes apply only to employees who are participating in the DB, the defined benefits plan, and did not convert to the defined contribution plan when it was created. No employee can participate in both the DB and the DC plans. We make that very clear throughout the bill. Section 1 also does something you'll see a number of places throughout the bill. It puts all TERS employers on an equal footing by requiring them to offer new employees the choice between the DB and the DC systems. That'll be uniform.
Let me just ask you, do you have any sort of anticipation about how many people would choose DC versus DB?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an analysis of that. I don't have a solid estimate. I think that one of the challenges we'll face when we have the State of Alaska's actuary review the bill, and I understand that process has begun, but it's not yet complete. We'll need to look at their estimates for how many people will make that choice and whether that changes the expectations of the systems in terms of, is it would more older employees, people who first hire on to the state at age 50, choose one than the other? How about younger employees? I don't yet have a solid estimate on that. Mr. Chairman, Sections 3 and 4 of the bill on page 2 require a person who receives disability benefits under the defined benefits tiers to seek work if they're where they're able and to receive medical examination. It sets some limits on the frequency of those exams. This is language that occurs in the defined contribution system. It was put in place, meant to be a safeguard to ensure that someone appointed to the very limited disability provisions in the defined contribution system was reevaluated. You're not on disability unless there's a presumption that you can't work in the future. There was a desire to give the plan administrator the ability to go back and check. So those provisions are copied to the new tier as well.
Yes, so let me just pause for 1 minute and recognize that Representative Munoz has joined us. Welcome, Representative Munoz.
Mr. Chairman, Sections 5 and 6 of the bill on page 3 establish a new eligibility standard for retiree medical benefits. This is the primary change in the new defined benefits tier. In the new defined benefits tier, a teacher with 25 years of service may receive medical benefits paid by the system. It would be what people would refer to as 25 and out. If you had 25 years of service as a teacher with TERS employers, you could take advantage of the system paying your medical benefits. If you did not have 25 years, and if you didn't put in the entire career, but you served at least 8 years, the system would pay your medical benefits once you are Medicare eligible. And that obviously is an eligibility level that has a potential to float. There's a proposal in front of Congress now to raise the Medicare eligibility age. The accrued benefit in this tier would, in essence, depend on what the federal government elected to do with that Medicare system to provide for our seniors. That, Mr. Chairman, is a critical change, and you'll see it reflected again in the public employees retirement system changes later in the bill. By pegging those retiree medical benefits to the Medicare eligibility, the system reduces the volatility of predicting the unpredictable nature of what our future medical liabilities will be. And it reduces the costs because, in essence, the retiree medical system for a great many of its beneficiaries will be a Medicare supplement, which costs dramatically less than paying the full medical insurance. The bill does retain system-paid medical benefits for members appointed to disability. And just as in the current defined benefits tier, if you have a retiree who does not have system-paid medical benefits, they have the ability to buy their insurance through the, in this case, the TERS system, but they pay the full boat. Section 7, Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page 3, clarifies that the defined contribution statutes
Let me pause it. Make sure I understand this. So under Tier 3, for instance, you work 10 years, you're vested medically. Under this new provision, there's no vesting until 25 years? Is that?
Mr. Chairman, in the teacher's retirement system, it's 8 years.
8 years, okay. So if you work 8 years, then you have vested for medical benefits under the proposed law?
Mr. Chairman, that's the minimum service requirement. Let me make sure I'm reading the bill correctly. Yes, that is, Section 6, page 3. Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. 8 years for a teacher, but then that teacher, before collecting that benefit, would have to be Medicare eligible.
Okay. So a teacher works 8 years, they become vested. They retire when they're, say, 60. They have no health insurance until 65. Is that how that would work?
No health insurance from the retirement
system. From the retirement
system. Correct.
But they could pay the $1,500 roughly a month and buy into that. Okay. And then under public employees, how many years? What's the vesting for public employees?
Under the new tier, just as with tier 3, it would be 10 years is the minimum service requirement. But again, as you'll see later in the bill, in the new tier, that would be pegged to Medicare eligibility before you could collect the benefit.
So basically what the difference between tier three and this would be, you're essentially eliminating that 7-year gap, I guess. You can retire at 58, I think, with the state, or is it 60?
Under tier three, it is 60.
Okay, so it's a 5-year gap where people are basically without insurance, you have to pay in. Is that the difference between tier three and this? Is that sounds
Chairman, I'm paging through my papers. I provided as part of the packet a comparison chart of the current defined benefits tiers. There we have it. And that provides a good description of the current. You'd be looking at the TERS Tier 2 benefits, which is the last of the defined benefit tiers. If you have in color, it would have a green top on it.
We don't have. Actually, I don't have.
Yeah, it's titled Alaska Division of Retirement and Benefits, Teachers Retirement System, TERS Plan Comparison.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. It's okay. My apologies, Senator.
Okay. Any other questions on this topic? Why don't you proceed, Jesse?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 7 of the bill is, again, clarifying language. It makes entirely clear that the defined contribution statutes apply only to employees who participate in the defined contribution plan and do not convert to the defined benefit system, in essence, who didn't hired under the new tier, who didn't choose DB. In fact, they chose DC. Again, no employee can participate in both the DB and the DC plans. The bill is consistent throughout. Section 8, again, puts all TERS employers on an equal footing by requiring them all to offer new employees the same choice. Mr. Chairman, Section 9 of the bill, you'll find on page 4. These are the provisions that give a newly hired teacher who doesn't have previous service in the teacher's retirement system the choice between defined benefit and defined contributions. It's a one-time choice. It's irrevocable. And it sets time frames and rules for the process. The mechanics would be that upon hire, an employee is in the defined benefit system, but they have the opportunity to elect within 60 days to participate in the defined contribution system. It's a one-shot deal, Mr. Chairman. So it requires certain information to be provided. The Division of Retirement Benefits has raised some concerns about the workability of the time frame, and Senator Regan will be happy to work with you and with the division to address the mechanics of that and make sure it's workable for school districts and for the division. Mr. Chairman, with Section 10 at the bottom of page 5, we begin to go through all the same moves over in the public employees retirement system. So I'll see if I can be a little quicker in walking through this. Section 10 is one of those clarifying pieces that makes clear that the defined benefit statutes only apply to DB employees, and nobody can participate in both plans. Section 10 also has language that puts all PERS employers on an equal footing by requiring them to provide new employees the choice. Section 11, you'll find on page 6, that sets the same minimum earning threshold for elected officials in the new defined benefits tier as the 2004 reform bill, Senate Bill 141, implemented. There was significant concern when Senate Bill 141 passed about some elected officials at the municipal level who are paid functionally an honorarium rather than a salary, who were in previous tiers gaining credit for their work, and their contributions and their employers' contributions were out of proportion to the benefits they earned. So this maintains that safeguard explicitly in the new tier. In sections 12 and 13, you'll see on and beginning on page 6, extend that same disability checkup to PERS employees. Section 14 is the new medical requirements for PERS members. It gets a little more complicated in PERS, Mr. Chairman, because you have two categories. You have police and fire employees, and you have what are referred to as PERS others. That's everyone from attorneys at the Department of Law to you and your staff to administrative clerks, fish biologists. Mr. Chairman, in the new DB tier, a peace officer, a firefighter, a full career is 25 years. It would match the new tier for the teacher's retirement system. So the system would pay benefits of 25 years of service, no matter your age. For other employees, that would be 30 years, what's referred to as 30 and out, you'll sometimes hear. For those employees who do not work that full career, it is 10 years of service is the minimum. And again, that's not collectible until you're Medicare eligible. Mr. Chairman, sections 15 and 16, again, is the language requiring all PERS employers to offer the choice. Section 17 is clarifying language, making sure that the defined contribution statutes apply only to DC employees. Nobody can run down both tracks at once. Section 18, we've made it to page 9 here. We're getting there. Again, puts all employers on the equal footing and requires all PERS employers to offer the choice. Section 19 is the mechanical section that gives newly hired public employees that choice. It works the same way. You're at the date of hire, you sort of default to the defined benefit system, but you have 60 days to elect the defined contribution system if that's what works better for you. Section 20, Mr. Chairman, are some repealers. They repeal sections in existing statute that let non-vested defined benefit employees convert into the defined contribution system and that required employers to match the money that the employees took out dollar for dollar. That would go away under this plan because new hires have the choice. And those non-vested employees in the DB tiers have had several years now to make the election. Repeal sections related to political subdivisions, cities, for instance, that participate only in the defined contribution plan because the bill requires all employers to offer new hires the choice. It repeals a requirement that defined benefit employees who refunded their contributions, who took their employee money out of the system, and who returned to work after July 1, 2010, that's a deadline that was in the Senate Bill 141, existing statute requires them to participate only in the defined contribution plan. This would repeal that, Mr. Chairman, and any such employee who came back to work for a PERS employer has no service credit. They have no tier. They would be a new hire. They would have the same choice as somebody who'd never worked for a public employer in the state of Alaska. That's the way this operates. Mr. Chairman, Section 21 gives those employees who are currently in the defined contribution system and did not have a choice a one-shot opportunity to elect to convert into the new defined benefits tier. Can't go back, but they would have the opportunity, same opportunity as a new hire, to move forward. The funds in their individual defined contribution account would be transferred into the PERS or TERS trust fund. The actuary would calculate their service. Actually, Mr. Chairman, that may not be correct. There may not be an actuarial calculation. No, there would be. I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, employees who make this choice into the new defined benefits tier would receive their full service credit for the time they worked. Any money in their defined contribution account would go into the trust fund, and the actuary would calculate, in essence, how much time that buys. To ensure that there is no unfunded liability when we start the new tier, this bill would require any deficiency in the money to be made up right up front, Mr. Chairman. And that, as the bill is drafted, we expect to see a fiscal note associated with that. Most defined contribution accounts are not adequate, we believe, to buy employees' time. That would be an upfront cost. It's important to note, Mr. Chairman, that the way these defined benefit systems work, is to pre-fund our liabilities. The combination of the employee and employer contributions pay the future cost of the benefit that is earned in the year you earn it. That's, we don't rely on current contributions to pay current benefits. There are some systems we're all familiar with. These are pre-funded systems. When you earn the benefit, when you accrue another year of service, the contributions from the employee and the employer pay that. So this provision would require that we do that right up front. I think that covers the contents of Section 20. There are also provisions making sure that that anyone who makes that Section 21, thank you. So employees who convert from the defined contribution plan under this provision would be defined benefit employees. They'd be governed by all those statutes that we referenced earlier. We made sure that nobody gets to walk down both roads at once and double benefit. It's not going to happen. Mr. Chairman, I believe, if I haven't lost my place, we're on Section 23, which allows the Commissioner of Administration to adopt regulations, and Section 24 gives an immediate effective date to the regulation rule authority and the conversion option, so that that can happen right away. Mr. Chairman, it's a long walkthrough, and I appreciate that the retirement legislation tends to be technical and has to do everything twice. But Senator Egan asked me to leave with you the important information that our defined benefits system pays unequivocally a more valuable benefit down the road than our defined contribution system. We knew that thanks to some analysis that the actuaries did shortly after the defined contribution system was adopted. And it does it, Mr. Chairman, for comparable or even lesser cost. Senator Egan included in your packet an analysis by an actuary very familiar with Alaska's PERS and TERS retirement system, Mr. William Fornia. And, Mr. Chairman, I know I've taken an awfully long time, so rather than walk through that in detail, I will point out that Mr. Fornia's analysis of the new tiers shows that they cost less than the prior defined benefits tiers, and in almost every case cost less than the defined contribution tier. But they provide the public employees, the public servants who serve Alaskans, both the state level and cities and school districts, with a more valuable benefit. It's also a dependable benefit, Mr. Chairman, and that's the definition of a defined benefit system. Most PERS and TERS retirements are not rich. They're not huge checks. The averages run in the $20,000 to $30,000 a year range. However, as Senator Egan pointed out in his opening comments, Mr. Chairman, they don't go down when the stock market tanks for a couple of years before it bounces back. Employees who rely only on cash plans, only on individual investment accounts, have to ratchet back their spending, and the impacts of that ripple through the economy. I included in your packet a page from a report called Pensionomics that looks at the economic impact of defined benefits payments in Alaska. And it's important to note that does not include Social Security, because PERS and TERS employees don't earn Social Security credit, and in most cases they see a reduction in any Social Security they earn from private sector work as a result of their government pension. The impacts on Alaska's economy are significant. It's a tremendous stabilizer when times are bad in the stock markets. And with this bill, you get the greater benefit for the lesser cost, Mr. Chairman. It makes good economic sense for the state of Alaska, as well as good public policy sense from a hiring standpoint and recruitment and retention. Rather than go on further, Mr. Chairman, I'll make myself available for any questions you or the committee might have.
All right. Thank you, Jesse. Questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, thank you. Okay, we have a presentation by the administration. We also have a few people sign up to testify. Let's do the public testimony first, and then we'll get to the administration presentation. We've got Brett. Is it Gilland or Gilland?
Gilland.
Come on up, Brett, and put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Hello. For the record, my name is Brett Gilland. I'm here at the bequest of NEA Alaska to testify in favor of Senate Bill 121. I teach mathematics at West Anchorage High School. My wife teaches science at Golden View Middle School, both in Anchorage. I would like to thank Senator Egan and the co-sponsors of Senate Bill 121, and also Senator Bilikowski for hearing this bill today. Roughly 2 years ago, I was invited by NEA Alaska to fly to Juneau and speak to the need to return to a defined benefit retirement plans for teachers and other public employees in the state of Alaska. And my message then was simple. By offering only a defined contribution plan, the state was creating a class of mercenary teachers with little incentive to stay in Alaska for their the entirety of their careers. As I argued then, the state's benefit plan made it so easy to work for a short while and then relocate to another state with a more secure retirement package, even while retaining the money sunk into retirement in Alaska, that it actively encouraged a class of mercenary teachers here to reap the benefits of impressive starting salaries while they had little to no family, increasing the burden of high cost of living here in Alaska. Only to leave for states with secure retirement options after their first few years. At the time, I was consistently told that my message would be more powerful if I could demonstrate examples of this sort of behavior. I have returned here in my third and final year as an Alaska teacher to reiterate my message and to offer myself as an example of the truth of that prediction. I absolutely love teaching at West Anchorage High School. I honestly believe that our outstanding and diverse student body, combined with our professional and motivated staff, combined to create a unique atmosphere of academic excellence that I've not experienced anywhere before in my education career, nor do I expect to experience that level of excellence again. My wife, herself a first-year teacher at Golden View Middle School, feels similarly about her own school. It is physically painful for me to consider moving to another state. And yet, as the year began and my wife and I began to work towards starting a family, we were forced to evaluate where we would be best situated for the long haul. There were many factors that weighed as we considered our options. However, a decision made by the state of Alaska 6 years ago clarified our thinking greatly. Neither my wife nor I are willing to risk our family's well-being by depending on a retirement that is insecure. Knowing that we do not have the stability of Social Security to rely on, knowing that we do not have the stability of a defined benefit retirement to rely on, we found ourselves unwilling to gamble on the prospect of a defined contribution plan. The stock market drop in 2008, which devastated my own parents' retirement, made it clear how risky that proposition would be. In the end, we realized that our question was not whether we would leave the state, but when we would leave the state. At that point, our decision became much simpler. We have resigned at our schools, and we're returning to New Mexico and a defined benefit retirement. Last week, I visited the Capitol with a colleague from Matsu School District, whose son, a special education teacher, and daughter-in-law, a physics teacher, both in Matsu as well, were packing their bags for states with a more secure retirement. When I returned home to share with my wife some of the conversations I've had, she told me to make sure that you knew that three of the four seventh grade science teachers in Golden View were headed out the door this year. The story in every case is the same as ours. Our families live elsewhere, and none of us feel we can afford the risk of retirement in Alaska under a defined contribution plan. We will not risk our family's well-being on that insecurity. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are losing 3 out of 4 seventh grade science teachers at Golden View Middle School, which is, as Senator Kiesel can tell you, a flagship school in Anchorage and in the state, you have a serious problem that needs fixing. With that in mind, there are a few notes I'd like to bring to your attention today. The first is this. I know that there are some in this room who believe that this problem can be put off for a little while longer. Jobs are tight outside, the thinking goes, so no one's going to risk a move. Note, however, the demographics of the teachers I just listed. Math, science, special ed. Teachers in those areas know that they are in high demand and will find work in short order. We can afford to move regardless of the economic climate. So unless you believe that the state does not need high-quality science, math, and special education instructors, do not believe that a tight economic climate means that this can wait. Secondly, I also know that there are plenty of people who know that the state is still having no problems attracting new candidates. And this is true, and it's unsurprising. Starting pay for teachers in Alaska is still very appealing, especially for young teachers with no family or with small families. However, the current system actively encourages them to walk out the door within 3 to 5 years, right when all studies show that they are hitting their peak effectiveness. So, unless it is your intent that Alaska simply be the training ground for America's teachers who will return to the lower 48 once their teaching skills are fully developed, you cannot afford to put this off any longer. Lastly, I don't know that I would have stayed in Alaska if SB 2121 had been on the books when I moved here. It would have been a very difficult decision for my wife and I to make. I do know that my brother and his wife, both middle school teachers in the Matsu School District, moved up here 8 years before me with all the same thoughts and concerns that I have, but with confidence in the security of their defined benefit retirement. They are staying for a long and productive career as educators in Alaska. However, with retirement as it is now, you never even gave me that choice. Without even an option of guaranteed retirement stability, staying would simply have put my family at too great a risk. My decision was made for me before I ever stepped foot in an Alaska classroom. Simply put, I am on my way out the door. It is too late to keep me here. I implore you to pass Senate Bill 121 and give future educators in Alaska the option to plan from the moment they start here to stay here and become excellent teachers throughout their career in Alaska. Thank you. And if you have any questions.
All right. Thank you, Brett. I don't see any questions. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, next up we have Josh Foster. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Josh Foster. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 121. My name is Josh Foster. I'm an Anchorage firefighter and a participant of Tier 4. Born and raised in Alaska, I attended Diamond High School. continued my education at UAA and UAF, and I work for the University Fire Department. I received my bachelor's in fire service administration. I was hired in 2007 by the Anchorage Fire Department. I was part of the first group that was hired under the defined contribution system, and the lack of a defined benefit retirement option system is a big concern for the group of 30 firefighters that were hired in that group. There's been talk about taking lateral transfers to the lower 48, where most fire departments in the states participate in a defined benefit system. A few members of our group have already reluctantly tested for departments out of state, but pulled out of the process at the last minute in hopes of a retirement fix. Both my wife's family and my family reside in Alaska. It is our intent to remain in Alaska and continue the work in the state that we love. In spite of our desires, we find it difficult to remain in our jobs without concrete and defined benefit for retirement. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 121 so that the people currently employed in Tier 4 system can continue to give back to the community and not be forced to take their expertise elsewhere. I would like to thank Senator Egan for bringing this important issue forward. I also would like to thank the committee for hearing Senate Bill 121. Any questions?
Thank you, Josh. I see no questions.
Thank you.
Okay, next up we have Stephen Tchaikovsky. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record. Give us your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Egan, for bringing this bill forward. Mr. Chairman, Senators, I appreciate you hearing me today. My name is Stephen Tchaikovsky. I'm currently a patrol officer working for the Anchorage Police Department. I'm here on behalf of my fellow officers and other officers in the state of Alaska. I'm a longtime Alaskan, as well as my wife and family. I was a military brat that moved here and fell in love with the state. I graduated from Bartlett High School in the top of my class. I went on to leave the state for college for 1 year to find out this is where I belong. I came back and then went to UAA, where I graduated among some of the first officers at the ROTC program at UAA. I went on to the Air Force to serve 4 years as an officer. During that time, I went numerous places in the states, many states, Mississippi, Florida, Montana, California, numerous opportunities to look at other places where my wife did work for other departments, agencies, cities, governments, businesses. At that time, we decided that we wanted to come back to Alaska. I left a pension with the military or a retirement and medical system on the hopes of coming back to Alaska and building my family here. At that time, the defined contribution was in the works and there was numerous opinions about it, but I had already started my process of coming home. At that time, when I got here, I did find out reluctantly that defined contribution was real when I signed the paperwork to become an officer with the Anchorage Police Department on April 30th of 2007. Since that date, I've worked with the police department here in Anchorage, and it's been one of the most rewarding jobs that I could do in Anchorage, serving the people, after doing my last job as a nuclear weapons launch officer. My last job was the same thing. It was very stressful, but not as rewarding as I wanted it to be. The current job I have now is a perfect fit for myself. Most people probably wouldn't want to do what I do, but I went through an academy. I spent numerous hours of training in Anchorage, learning a job that is a very rewarding job. Of those people that were in my academy, 40% never made it to the streets of Anchorage to serve the citizens. Those people either failed out, couldn't pass the tests, found out this is not what they wanted to do, or got other offers, other places, or simply just decided that this was not going to work for them. Those training costs for those officers, a lot of times are never seen. A lot of the numbers that are thrown out are $130,000 to $150,000 to train an officer such as myself. Problem is a lot of times those numbers don't take into account those 40% that walked out the door. Those individuals, all that money went into training them, is lost money. Those people just left, never made it to the street. Unfortunately, it's a high attrition rate in my career field to get somebody on the street as a trained professional. I'm actually here testifying in place of the officer that was here before you, before Officer Garcia. He is currently gone and has gone to another state with a defined benefit, believe it or not. He is one of the officers that has already pulled the pin and left. We have another officer who's gone to the U.S. Marshals. I know of currently 6 officers just on my shift alone that are looking at other options. I currently actually have an offer in front of me from the Air Force to go back to them. And this one's actually dated from about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I get these all the time. I could easily leave the state, go anywhere, any of those other places where military bases are at, and have a retirement system for me and my family. I actually took a pay cut to come back to Anchorage. Most people aren't willing to do that. I did that to bring my family back to Alaska and build my family. I actually had my daughter after I came back to Alaska and started my family here. I love my job. I love what I do. It's not the most productive job for a family. I work night shift. I work in Mountain View, East Anchorage, the parts of the city that a lot of people don't get to see at night. I've personally been involved in homicides, officer-involved shootings, baby not breathing. I've actually had to tell a mom that her kid didn't make it. It's hard to go home from that and look at your kid the same way, not knowing what I'm going to be able to provide to her if I go home that night. With all that, I still love my job. I go back to work every day. This is currently my weekend. I'm going to go back to work Saturday night again, serving the citizens of Anchorage. But it's hard. I personally loaded Officer Jean Mills into the ambulance after she was shot on duty. The worst part was when my wife didn't know who was shot. She found out on the news that morning an East Anchorage officer was shot in the line of duty. And she had all those thoughts of, what am I going to do with my family? What am I going to do? And one of those things that popped into her mind was, you know, you don't even have a retirement. What happens if something happens to you at work? Okay, so even if you do make it through your career, my job is very hard on a person. Work night shift, work weekends, and it's very hard on a family. I would like to keep my family here in Alaska and keep my family. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that with the current system with a defined contribution. That ability to have a choice for a defined benefit with some security for my family, as well as other officers and other public servants, is a huge, huge thing that I could take off my plate and not worry about when I'm dealing with everybody else's problems at work. That's my job and I love it. But I don't want to have to worry about in the back of my head how much do I have in my 401k when things like this are going on, or how much do I have for retirement when really I'm driving to respond to help you or somebody else or a family member or a friend with a child that can't breathe. Fellow officers are currently being recruited actively at my department by other departments down south. They see us as a chance to get some of the best trained officers in the states. We have people that go to the Air Marshals. We have people that go to the FBI in the past, and they have seen our level of training, and it's among some of the best in the states. They are actively seeking us because they can offer us a defined benefit. What I'm hoping is that in the short term, I can stay here and sustain my job and my benefits that I have now in the hopes that Senate Bill 121 will change my decision, and hopefully I will not have to make the same choices other people have testified before you and decide to choose my family and leave the state of Alaska. Considering that I've left once and the state already pulled me back, I left for college, I left for employment with the Air Force, and it's hard for me to turn down the Air Force when they call all the time saying, why are you staying? I can go back, finish my time there, but I would rather serve the citizens of Anchorage. I'd rather serve Alaskans. I would rather spend my life here with my family and raise them here. And Senate Bill 121 will help me with that decision, because I have yet to make that decision, and I'm hoping that this will sway me. Senators, I'd like to thank you for your time and listening to me today. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Stephen. Questions? See none. Thank you. And thank you all for your service to our state. Okay, that's the last person to sign up for public testimony on my list. We do have the administration here, and if we could call Mr. Barnhill and anyone else you wish to bring up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. We're going to pause just a second while Ms. Lee plugs in the jump drive so we can project the presentation we're going to make.
Is this going to be a minute or so? You want to take a brief at ease, or do you want to jump into your testimony?
It shouldn't take more than a second to just put it in. I'll go ahead and get started. Mr. Chair, I'm joined at the table by Ms. Kathy Lee, who is the Deputy Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits. In the audience, joining me as well is Commissioner Becky Hultberg and Deputy Commissioner John Kramer of the Department of Administration, as well as Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett from the Department of Revenue and the Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits, Mr. Jim Puckett. Mr. Chair, I'm here today to testify in opposition on behalf of the Department of Administration and the Governor's Office to SB 121. In presenting this testimony, I want to assure the committee that we recognize and understand the good intentions of the sponsors of this bill. We recognize and understand the concerns of the folks that testified previous to me. We're very gratified with the excellent service that these individuals have provided the state of Alaska as policemen, as firefighters, as teachers. That service is incredibly important. But it illustrates the primary concern that the administration has with this bill and forms the central theme of what I'm going to present to you today. And that is, at this time, the administration does not believe that the state of Alaska has the financial capability to extend defined benefit promises to a new generation of state employees. Those promises could last up to 70 years. And until the state of Alaska fixes its long-term fiscal situation, which is worse? To be honest with these hardworking, dedicated public servants and tell them that the state at this time can't make those promises, or to make those promises and potentially have a situation where they've relied for their entire career, 30 years, that the state is going to be there for them, that these plans are going to be there for them. And then in 2070 and 2080, we're not.
Just pause you for 1 second. It's my understanding that Alaska is the only state in the country that does not offer either a social, we've opted out of Social Security, and we don't have a defined benefit system for our public employees. Is that my understanding that we're the only state in the country?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I have the most current information. We are not the only state that has opted out of Social Security.
Well, I know that, but the only state that's opted out of Social Security and doesn't offer some form of defined benefit system for
the employees. Get back to you on that. I can tell you at this point in time, many, many states across the country, and I have a long list, I've got a handout from the National Council of State Legislatures that identifies all the states that are currently right now considering closing their defined benefit plan and moving new employees to a defined contribution plan, exactly as Alaska did in 2005.
Okay.
So if we are the only state today, it's not likely to last.
Right. Do you know? Are you familiar with how much savings? What's the total accumulated savings the state has? My understanding is it's $14 billion.
Yes.
Do you? How big is the permanent fund now?
Just one over $40 billion.
Is it fair to say that we have the largest savings account in the United States?
I think that's probably fair to say.
Is it fair to say we're probably in the best financial condition of any state in the United States?
That is subject to question whether you're talking long-term or short-term, Mr. Chair. Short-term, I can say, yes, we've got a lot of money in the bank, but again, these promises are promises we make for 70 to 80 years. In fact, I just heard that the oldest PERS retiree died recently at the age 106. So if we make a new promise today to a defined benefit person who's 20 years old, we could potentially, assuming mortality expectations remain constant, which you You can't assume that. Next 70 to 80, even 90 years.
If you could design a system where you hire actuaries, I mean, this is how a defined benefit system works. You hire actuaries, you figure out how long people are going to live, you figure out how much benefits you're going to have to pay out, and you figure out how much benefits you need to take in, it should equal out, shouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, I've got a fair amount of experience with that, having come from the Department of Law where we litigated a case on that very issue for several years. Yeah, theoretically, it should even out, but the theory doesn't seem to work in practice, at least it hasn't in the state of Alaska for the last 10 years. And you can have any number of reasons why the theory doesn't work out, some because of actuarial negligence, we've had personal experience with that, and some because assumptions just change. Over time, people live longer. There are scientific medical discoveries where currently mortality may be 80 years, but who knows what's going to happen 30 years from now. There may be some amazing cure that's developed, and now people are living to 90 years or 100 years consistently. During that intervening 30-year period, we were saving for those employees as if they were going to die around age 80. Now we suddenly have an unfunded liability for the entire system because we have to pay benefits 10, 20 years longer. That could happen. Even with the best actuary, they cannot predict technological advances and medical advances that will change mortality. In fact, we've experienced that just this year. We had an actuarial study done under SB 141, which is required every 4 years, and they found out people on average are living longer. That produced some demographic assumption changes, which the Army Board just adopted. And as a consequence, that and some other reasons, the unfunded liability has just increased $1 billion in the space of 1 year. Those kind of actuarial changes are going to happen consistently. When you're talking about starting a new generation of benefits, you're talking about 70 years. We think about what's happened in this country over the past 70 years that changes in mortality.
But isn't that why you hire actuarials to figure out what the mortality rates are going to be?
But the actuarials, Mr. Chair, the actuaries, they base their mortality assumptions on experience. Their job is not to predict medical advances that extend the lifespan of an average person.
On the Mercer case, what was the initial estimate of the loss? What was the initial estimate of the cost of the malpractice by Mercer?
The initial estimate when we first filed the complaint was $1.3 billion. And that was attributable to a number of factors, negligence that was identified by an actuarial auditor, as well as subsequent work that we did in preparing the case. We subsequently increased that claim to $2.3 billion based on the discovery of fraud.
So you had an actuary that committed malpractice and fraud and was negligent, and to the tune of $2.3 billion?
Right.
And how much did the state settle that case for?
$500
million. And in your research, did you find that the state had fully funded the defined benefit system during the time that it was supposed to be paying contributions?
The state did not fully fund the system during that time period for reasons attributable to actuarial negligence as well as other reasons that were not negligence. And that we did not pursue in that litigation. You may recall in 2003, that was when the results of the actuarial audit that was performed on FY02 were released, and that's when we first learned we had a $4.4 billion unfunded liability. We only saw some meaningful fraction of that unfunded liability because the unfunded liability developed for a variety of reasons, including investment losses, which is another thing that actuaries can't predict.
Other questions? Okay, why don't you proceed with your...
I betcha. So the theme of our presentation today, Mr. Chair, is the distinction between making promises and the hard work it takes to keep them. And I want to explain to the committee today the promises that we've made to date, and what we're going to do to keep those promises, the difficulty in keeping those promises, and the difficulty that we have at this time in supporting the notion that we should extend new promises to a new generation of state employees. promises, and this is a 30,000 foot review of the promises that we've made to date. But essentially, we're offering a pension to folks that work 30 years for the state that amounts to 67.5% of their average salary. We provide annual cost of living increases and system paid medical premiums for tier one when they retire at age 55, for tier three when they retire at age 60. We've made that promise to close to 100,000 people and their families. We intend to keep those promises. We have a constitutional, quite frankly, a moral obligation to keep those promises, but they come at a high cost and a long-term cost. At this point in time, Buck Consultants, the plan's actuaries, projects that these benefits for the closed PERS and TERS DB plans will need to be paid through 2080. Starting from today and for the next 50-some years, those hard liabilities will be in excess of $1 billion per year. If you turn to the next page, you can see the how the hard liabilities crest. For a 20-year period, 2026 to 2047, the benefit payments by the system will exceed $3 billion a year. It's a huge responsibility.
What's the present value of that? In other words, is this in nominal dollars, or what is it?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, that is nominal dollars. Yes, that is not in present dollars.
So not discounted
dollars. It is not discounted, no. Discounted or no, the costs are significant. We've experienced consistently through the 2000s decade the issue of continually increasing cost of defined benefit plan benefits. People are living longer than expected. People are retiring earlier than expected. Health costs continue to substantially exceed the rate of inflation. This is how we plan to keep the promises that we've made. The PERS and TERS systems currently have about $16 billion in assets. We'll continue to collect under SB 125 from 2008, 22% of payroll from PERS employers, 12.5% of payroll from TERS employers, 6.75% from PERS defined benefit employees, slightly higher for police and fire, 8.65% from TERS defined benefit employees. That's not enough. The unfunded liability, as I said, is $11 billion. The total employer contribution rates for PERS are going to be over 30% now. They're going to increase in FY13 to close to 33%. For TERS, it's going to approach 50%. So in order to meet these promises that we've made, we are currently turning to the general fund under SB 125. The SB 125 draw on the general fund at this point is projected to exceed $1 billion a year, that's nominal dollars, by the end of this decade. It's going to increase to $1.4 billion by the middle of the next decade.
Yes, Senator Pascvan.
In the 22% of payroll on PERS employers, what is the base wage percentage?
Through the chair, Senator Pascvan, are you referring to normal cost?
Normal cost.
The normal cost of the system, Senator Pascvan, for PERS is just over 9%. It fluctuates between 8 and 10%. So the components of that 22% include the normal cost, which is, let's say, call it 9%, the amount that the PERS employers pay for the DCR employees, and I believe that's about 2%, is that right? 2% of total payroll. So let's say, roughly speaking, 11% goes to normal cost and the defined contribution costs, leaving a balance of 11% that they're paying on past service costs. If past service costs about 20%. So they're paying, the total cost is 30-some percent. So they're paying, I don't know, roughly a third to under a half of the past service cost, leaving the balance for the state.
So what is the gross payroll for PERS employers, approximately?
I'd have to look at the valuation, Senator Passman, to give you the gross payroll. Do we have that? We'll have to get you that number.
You could get that to my office. We'll distribute it the committee members. Yes, Senator Passman has a follow-up.
And I was wondering, of the past service costs at 11%, that's part of the 22%, is that being channeled towards the unfunded liability?
Yes, sir.
Right, and do you have an estimate on how many hundreds of millions of dollars then are being channeled towards the unfunded liability at this time?
In total, through the chair, Senator Passman, for FY12, the state under SB 125 is contributing $474 million to the unfunded liability, and the PERS and TERS employers, the TERS employers do not contribute anything to the TERS unfunded liability. The state picks that up almost completely. The PERS municipal employers pay some figure. It's a meaningful figure. I don't have the exact number. It's probably in the range of a couple hundred million dollars.
Senator Passman.
In FY11, was the payment to buy down the unfunded liability in excess of $800 million when the Mercer settlement monies were added with the 11% past service cost monies?
So through the chair, Senator Passman, the Mercer settlement netted just about $400 million. And then the SB 125 payment for FY11 was $300 some million. So added together, yes, that was I don't think it was quite $800 million. Somewhat less than that.
700 to 800 million, something in that range.
It was less than 800 million.
Please continue.
And the final point is that we plan to make all benefit payments when due. And you've seen how those are going to increase in the coming years. We've got a number of current difficulties. The cost of promised benefits keeps increasing. The unfunded liability is projected now to exceed $11 billion. The PERS and TERS rates are increasing. And I guess the point I'm trying to make here is, even with the best of actuaries, there are certain things they will not be able to project. Changes in mortality, investment losses, those things without any negligence on the part of the actuary will continue to create unfunded liabilities from now until the last defined benefit retiree expires. And that's just something we have to recognize as a fact of life with defined benefit plans.
Can I just ask you a question? Does the administration had any discussions or any plans to increase current employees' retirement ages or reduce current employees' benefits?
Mr. Chair, there is no plan to reduce employees' benefits, retirement benefits, if that's what you're asking. That's prohibited under the Constitution by the Diminishment Clause, Article 12, Section 7, which prohibits the diminishment of benefits, retirement benefits, and that's been examined by the Alaska Supreme Court in two cases, Hammond versus Hoffbeck and Duncan versus RPEA. And the Supreme Court has held that the benefit promises that the state extends vest upon the commencement of employment. So there's no legal way to diminish benefits to state employees. I will say that in both of those decisions, there's a footnote in which the court has reserved for a later date to consider whether diminishments can be made in the case of fiscal crisis. And we hope, quite frankly, never to have to trigger that. The road ahead for maintaining or keeping our, I'm sorry.
Senator Passman.
How would you define fiscal crisis?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, I'm not going to try and define that. Quite frankly, you don't want me to try to define that at this time.
Actually, we do.
You may regret it in the future, so it's just no point in trying to set a bar.
Have you had any discussions about what a fiscal crisis would be or whether we're in a fiscal crisis?
Mr. Chair, we are not in a fiscal crisis at this time. These plans are not well-funded. The funding of these plans is poor, to be quite honest. But we have assets. We have revenue streams. We have the general fund. We have ways of making it from now until the end of these plans, which we're projecting to finally close around 2080. So we're not here to suggest that there should be any kind of alarm with respect to the current DB plan, but we are here to suggest that the capacity to extend these kind of benefits with this kind of volatility and this kind of uncertainty is unwise to a new generation of state employees, particularly when we have the fiscal situation of this state the way it is now. And by that, I mean in specific, we've got a slide coming up in a minute here, that the production trend on TABS, as you know, has been steadily down for 20 years. We've heard over the past week or so that TAPS could extend to 2047, according to a recent judicial opinion, 2065. That's great. That will secure the promises that we have made for the existing DB plan. But if you open a new DB plan, well, we have to extend the promises through 2080, 2090, 2100. What can we promise in terms of a backstop to this new generation of firefighters and police who are going to be relying on that promise for the entirety of their careers? And I would suggest to you, Mr. Chair, respectfully and with all complete acknowledgement for the concerns of this committee, that at this time the state of Alaska cannot make that guarantee that the general fund will be there at the end of this century to make good on the promises we make today.
If I just want to take a minute, if you look at the revenue projections, the spring forecast, the throughput on TAPS is actually declining. So where we've been on a 6% decline over the last 25 years or so, the Department of Revenue is actually projecting the decline has stemmed to 2.1%, which is good. They're also projecting that with the price of oil, we'll be in good financial shape. If we were to remove $2 billion per year from the budget, from the general fund available to the state, would that create a fiscal crisis, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, you keep wanting to butt me down on fiscal crisis, and I'm just not going to go there. But to the extent that you're asking, can we solve this problem by basically paying off the $11 billion unfunded liability over a five-year time period, will that solve our problems? And what that will do, Mr. Chair, is it will pay off the unfunded liability. So now we'll have $27 billion in the bank to pay this stream of benefits, these hard liabilities that were on, you know, that big red hump over the next 70 years. We will still be exposed to the risk of mortality changes, increasing health costs, and investment loss, and unfunded liabilities could crop up at any time in that time period.
And just what is the state's credit rating right now?
AAA, Mr. Chair.
Is that the best there is?
That's the best there is.
When you're talking to the credit reporting agencies, are you talking to them about? Are you telling them how about the impending crisis that we have with all these unfunded liabilities? Are they still giving us a AAA rating knowing that these exist? Or?
Mr. Chair, I don't speak with the credit agencies. My colleague, Mr. Burnett, does, but we issue 30-year bonds, and we don't have any problems for 30 years. What we're talking about today, Mr. Chair, is 70-year promises, and that's what we want to make sure, that the state is willing and able to commit to backstopping for that time period. That's what's important here.
Senator Pasford?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I understand you're conveying the personal pessimism that you have, and I'm not so pessimistic as to Alaska's future, but the point of my question is that if we don't have a definition of economic crisis or fiscal crisis, how do we know when we are just operating within personal pessimism as compared to an objective standard that we're in a fiscal economic crisis? And so that's what I'm struggling with at the moment, and particularly putting it into the context of the throughput, you know, the technological advances of heavy oil and the technological advances of shale oil and the potential for other areas opening up on the spectrum of Alaska's development. I'm trying to piece that all together.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pasvan, I'm glad you asked that question. And it's not that I am pessimistic about the future, but how will we know we're on the right path, Senator Pasvan, when that chart shows an uptick? That chart hasn't showed an uptick, a meaningful uptick, since the 80s. So what I would just respectfully suggest to this committee is that you don't count your chickens before they hatch. When we have a meaningful uptick in throughput, then that's the time to have this discussion. When that uptick looks like it's going to be sustainable. Now, you folks have heard some pretty exciting things this session, hydrofracking on the North Slope, gas line, offshore drilling. Those are all great things. I'm optimistic, and the administration is optimistic, that those things will come to pass. But don't count your chickens before they hatch. Let's see that chart change. Let's see that chart change on a sustained basis. That's the time to have this discussion. Not now. Don't make promises now that we can't guarantee. We're not going to be there for these people in 2080.
Senator Pasvan.
As part of your analysis, have you factored in the risk to Alaska of losing the highly competent police officers, highly competent teachers, the highly competent young employees that want to build their families here? I mean, it seems to me we're hearing that more and more. Have you factored in the loss of that throughput for, as you say, for 80 years?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pasvan, those concerns are real, and I'm not here to diminish them in any way. To me, what I have to balance as I'm making a policy recommendation to this administration and to your committee is which is worse, telling those people the truth about the current state of Alaska's long-term finances and giving them the choice now, while they're young, to go somewhere else and provide for their retirements if that's what they want, a defined benefit plan, or making a promise that we're not certain we can keep when they most need it. When I weigh those two concerns, regrettably, my recommendation is to stay with the status quo until that chart changes. Now, Alaska has a lot going for it, Mr. Chair. It's a great place to come and live. Lots of people come every year to try it out. We get a lot of good new people, good new teachers, good firefighters, good police people. Is that the way I want it to be? Perhaps not. That's not the best way. But it is, quite frankly, the most honorable and moral way for the state to proceed at this time.
But I have a different opinion on the obligation that I believe that Alaska owes to its current firefighters, police officers, teachers, public employees, than to tell them to look elsewhere. I just find that just an unacceptable loss to the state of Alaska.
I respect your opinion, sir.
I mean, to me, this is a basic math equation. If you have, the state is contributing money into Tier 4. The public employees contribute money into Tier 4. I can't believe we can't figure out a system where you're putting a certain amount of money in and you're doing the actuarial tables. I mean, we've got smart people in the state. We've got very smart people in the administration all across the state. I just can't believe we can't figure out a system where if we need to put a little more money in by the public employees, we have them put a little more money in, but it all equals out in the end. I just can't believe we can't figure out a system that can do that. Are you saying we can't?
Mr. Chair, this discussion is playing out in state legislatures all across the country, and the bottom line is that...
We don't care how they do it outside, do we?
The bottom line, Mr. Chair, is that lots of smart folks have looked at this, and in a defined benefit plan like this plan, the risks are on the employer, and these risks will continue to be present in this plan until the data closes. That's just the bottom line. Now, if you can find some folks that can predict the future with certainty, that's the only way you're going to solve these problems.
But here's the problem if you're asking each individual person to go out and basically manage their own particular retirement, which is what we're doing, because they have no Social Security, they have no defined benefit, they have some savings, the problem is that person doesn't know if they're going to live till they're 65 or they're going to live till 100. Whereas the state actuarially can smooth that out. So if you're a person who's trying to prepare for your retirement, it's extremely difficult for just you, that one singular person. But when everyone pulls their, when the state goes ahead and does that, you can say, okay, we need a little more contribution from the employees, but we'll be able to smooth it out because we can smooth out those differences. Individual employees can't do that.
Mr. Chair, there's no question that investing in the aggregate has some efficiencies that defined contribution accounts cannot provide. The status quo for TERS defined benefit, TERS Tier 4 and I'm sorry, PERS Tier 4 and TERS Tier 3 does provide some meaningful benefits to these employees, and we provided some calculations to your office and to Senator Ellis. A range 16 employee who works for the state for 30 years in PERS will end up with and invested at a very conservative rate of 4% annual return, will end up with a DC account at the end of that 30 years of approximately $400,000+. They'll end up with an SBS account of approximately $400,000+. And it's hard for me to sit here today and say $800,000 is inconsequential to a range 16 employees. It's meaningful.
Well,
it's a big chunk of change. And if they're lucky and they get something more than 4%, say 5%, you're beginning to close in on defined contribution in SBS account of $1 million.
I'm glad you brought that up. And I actually had my staff pull that letter. You take a range 16, step A, over 30 years. If you have someone in 30 years who's got $800,000 in their bank account, they have no Social Security, they have no other savings, they have no other pension, you used to have a three-legged stool. You used to have Social Security, a defined benefit, and savings. Now you've taken away Social Security, you've taken away the defined benefit. All you've got is savings of $800,000 in 30 years, which you pull out at 4% a year, you're talking $32,000 a year in 30 years. You think someone can live on $32,000 a year in 30 years?
You know what?
That total savings?
Mr. Chair, people can and do every day across this country. My parents do. Folks make do with what they have. What I'm here to tell you today is that is a meaningful amount of money that people can plan for and live on during retirement. Is it as good as a defined benefit plan? Probably not.
Mr. Chair.
Isn't the purpose of the defined benefit is that the employee that is long-lived takes, so to speak, advantage of the employee that's short-lived, so that right now in a defined contribution system, the employee's monies are extracted from the system and for example, an employee that dies young now, those monies, the retirement monies, aren't paid out by the state because of the early death, and those monies then are used to fund the person that lives long. So if whether it's $800,000 or $1 million, whatever the number is, if one looks at only living an average statistical life, it may be acceptable on an average statistical life, but aren't you then cursed, so to speak, that if you're the long-lived employee and not wanting to run out of money at age 80, if you happen to be the person that's going to live to 90 or 95 or 100? Isn't that the whole purpose of the leveling of a defined benefit?
Through the chair, Senator Bassman, that's certainly a benefit to the defined benefit plan, unquestionably.
Mr. Barnhill, we got about 3 minutes left. Fascinating discussion, good discussion, I think. I think it's appreciate the dialogue. We do have very busy in the last days here. Sure. If you could take a couple minutes and maybe wrap up. My hope is that perhaps over the interim we could have a hearing or two on this, and maybe delve a little bit more into this. I know this is an important topic. It's one that I hear a lot about. I know other members hear a lot about this issue. So I'll give you a couple more minutes, and then we're going
to
wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we look forward to having further discussions with you and the committee and other stakeholders on this issue over the interim and into the next session. Even though we oppose this bill, we recognize the concerns that drive it. The Division of Retirement Benefits is here to support all your requests for information, and we will endeavor to do that in as timely and as effective manner as we can. We have not submitted a fiscal note yet. As it turns out, the sections that Mr. Keel were talking about at the end of the bill, sections 21 and 22, because they require a one-for-one transfer of service credit for existing defined contribution employees into the defined benefit plan, the actuary will have to evaluate on a case-by-case basis what the cost of the general fund will be. Because as Mr. Keel said, those employees have been contributing 13%, the 8% that the employee contributes and the 5% that the state contributes to the defined contribution accounts. Those defined contribution accounts got hit by the Great Recession. In the meantime, the state's been contributing closer to 30% for defined benefit employees. So the chance that you can do a one-for-one transfer of service credit is non-existent. There will be a GF impact. It will have to be calculated on an employee-by-employee basis. We will get that fiscal note to you as soon as it's completed. I want to conclude by just looking at the issue of whether SB 121 does actually save money. And I think, Mr. Chair, really it's common sense here. It's been represented to you, and with all due respect to Senator Egan and his staff, that SB 121 saves money. At the same time, it's represented to you that the defined benefit is a more valuable benefit. If we all agree that defined benefit is a more valuable benefit, it's got to cost more. It does cost more. Simple math, the state contributes 5% normal cost to the defined contribution system. It can, as we discussed earlier, right now, normal cost for the defined benefits, 9%. That's going to change. Obviously, it goes up. The overall employer contribution rates, obviously, much, much higher in the defined benefit plan. The risks are much higher in the defined benefit plan. It will cost more money in the long term. Transferring the account balances into the defined benefit trusts, there's about $300 million there today. We have an unfunded liability of $11 billion. It will not make a meaningful dent. It won't change contribution rates, since existing contribution rates are calculated on the combined payroll, DB, and DC base. We would love to see a system, a defined benefit system, that actually saved costs. But quite frankly, Mr. Chair, we don't think that exists. And for that reason, that is why states across the country seeking to follow Alaska's example that we set in 2005, save costs, and close their defined benefit plan. Mr. Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to present the administration's position in opposition to this bill. We want to keep the retirement promises that we have made to date. We don't want to make the problem worse. We don't want to make new retirement promises that we cannot keep. A revenue backstop is necessary to ensure new promises are kept until Alaska's long-term, and I mean through the end of this century, fiscal situation is solved. This discussion, with respect, is premature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barna, for your testimony. As I mentioned, we'll continue to work on this bill in the interim with the stakeholders and the administration to look for common ground. In closing, I want to thank the committee members again, our secretary, LAO staff, and our committee staff, Michelle Seideman. And with that, we're adjourned.